We've been covering innovation within Australia a bit of late on Saturday Extra because questions of funding it featured in the budget, as you know, with cuts to the CSIRO and to the Australian model, the Cooperative Research Centre, the CRCs. But it's a very big topic, and it's dotted throughout modern business literature with all manner of different approaches to achieving it. At a big business conference in Sydney this week, one of the world's most prominent thinkers on the subject, Gary Hamel, was suggesting that management itself needed to be reinvented to innovate itself before it had any chance of delivering it in the broad sense. He believes that management as a concept has had about 100 years of life, and that it really is due for renovation. That it was a development of the early 20th century, he says, to accompany the systematic shifting of the population from agricultural pursuits to something far more organised. And that in deep ways, the model now needs to change the way it thinks about itself and its role in chains of 21st century production. However, bringing that to established businesses can be tricky, as he explained to me when I interviewed him outside the World Business Forum. He's a visiting professor in strategic and international management at the London Business School and co-founder of MIX, the Management Innovation Exchange. Gary Hamel.
You know, there's no way you take a legacy business and you make it highly innovative and highly adaptable by simply bolting on some small program, some initiative. You really have to go back to the basics and say, well, the companies, the organizations we have today, they were built around principles like standardization, specialization, hierarchy, unity of command. The organizations that we need for the future have to be built around a new set of principles. By the way, they still have to be very disciplined and focused and efficient, but now we need organizations that are built around principles of experimentation and openness and transparency and meritocracy. So this is going to be a journey. And I think what many people forget is if you go back to the kind of end of the 19th century, let's say about 1880, 1890 in the developed world, there would have been very few people who could have imagined that 25 years hence, Ford Motor Company would be making 500,000 cars a year. The idea that you could do something of that scale with that repeatability was an enormous, new human invention. So people today say, well, how do we do this? Well, I think our challenge is no greater than the challenge that they had at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We have to find a way of having control and freedom coexisting in our organizations. And I think there's some great models and some simple places to start.
So offer me some models.
I think in a lot of organizations, there's kind of a soft tyranny at work that we've become inured to. It's almost invisible. You know, if I walk around Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, anywhere in Australia, just about everybody I meet on the street can buy an automobile. They may have to take a loan, maybe a used car, but we trust them to make what is, after all, a very important economic decision. We take that same person and we put an employee badge on them, and at work, they can't requisition a $200 office chair without getting someone's permission. So, like, do they just suddenly get stupid when they walk? Do we not trust them? So the way you start to change that is not all at once. It's not everybody do your own thing. But you start to look for opportunities to kind of reverse that ratchet of control. I'll give you an example. One of my favorite companies in the United States, Whole Foods, the most profitable grocery retailer in the United States, a leader in organics and so on. They built the company on the foundation that they wanted people to feel like they were running their own businesses. So if you're a store employee, they're part of a small team in produce or meat or packaged goods. You set the prices. You decide what merchandise goes on the shelves. You determine the hours that you and your colleagues are going to work, and you get to hire people. So if I want to work at Whole Foods, I can go through the first level of selection, but then they will put me with a team for a couple of weeks or a month, and it takes a 70% vote of that team to bring me on board. Well, why is that such a hard issue?
But does that person become the new manager?
No, it doesn't become a manager, but becomes part of that team. So every hire is a team hire, rather than my boss saying, guess what, here's your new colleague, good luck. Mm. You know, you think about, you know, how the web has changed our lives as consumers. We are so empowered now. But if you work at our work, if you look at our work lives, that mostly hasn't happened. Organizations are still a mostly feudal system. And I think, you know, maybe you could afford this in the industrial economy. You certainly can't afford it in the creative economy. And there are ways of starting very small, like the example I just gave, where, you know, the earth doesn't stop spinning on its axis when you start asking, how do you give people step by step more control over their work lives?
Yes, and yet you do say that making this sort of change requires, and you quote a good friend of yours, C.K. Prahalad, used to say, being both commissar and guru. Now, that is a very tricky fit, isn't it?
You know, it is a tricky fit, but I would say that today, in a world of enormous change, you have to be able to have revolutionary goals and evolutionary steps. You have to be able to imagine, just like those folks 120 years ago, we have to be able to imagine organizations that work in fundamentally different ways than the ones we have now. And in a way, that's not so much of a stretch. Think about this. Every major new software platform over the last decade has started out as an open source project. Right now, about 300,000 open source projects around the world. A few years ago, how many CEOs would have said that you could build something as complex as an enterprise application with millions of lines of code using an army of volunteers? Well, now that doesn't only happen. It is the predominant way of developing one of the most complex things that human beings make. So you have to be able to start by imagining, you know, is there really a very different way of doing this? At the same time, organizations start from where they are. You have to start with one small experiment, one small step at a time. No one's going to give you permission to blow up the old model to, you know, this is not occupy the CEO's office. But you do have to be able to imagine a very different outcome, a very different future. Because to be frank, our organizations are just up against challenges that they were never built to handle.
Well, you say it's quite an inflection point. What do you mean by that?
The way we think about human beings at work is likely to change more in the next decade than it's changed in the last 100 years. And I think there's three things that are driving that are all quite simple. Organizations of all types are up against some new challenges that lie outside the performance envelope of that old management model. That traditional hierarchical top-down decision-making process where change had to start and be endorsed at the top, it is simply too slow in the world we live in now, and every CEO actually already knows that. Number two, the thing that's driving this is that you have a generation coming to work that is the first generation in human history whose primary social reference point is not a hierarchy. For those of us who have a bit of gray hair, it was school, it was business, it was government, it was church, whatever, but they were all built on that old model. Now you have this generation coming to work who've grown up on the web where you have this belief that every idea should compete on its own merits, that you should be measured not by your credentials but by your contribution, and that if you're a leader, you're only a leader because people are willing to follow you. Well, those people, when they come to work, they're not going to surrender those beliefs. They're going to take them into the workplace, and if they don't find a work environment that matches that reality, they will go somewhere else. And then finally, I think the third thing that's making all this both inevitable and possible is we have all these new tools, the new tools of the social web, that allow us to collaborate and work together so you can get collaboration and coordination without centralization. Those tools didn't exist a decade ago. So that combination of new challenges, new expectations, new tools, I think make this inevitable. The question is, who's going to lead and who's going to follow?
But that presupposes that a lot of people do want that level of power. And I'm not so sure that is necessarily a good judgment, that a lot of people wish to turn up and even be recognised, but then walk away. And that part of the thing that distinguishes leaders is their readiness to stay helicoptered above the rest, copping it all.
Not everyone has the same aspiration. Not everyone really wants to be a leader. Having said that, I think most people, however, do aspire to have impact. They do aspire to make a difference. There's a lot of learned helplessness in organizations because change is so difficult, because we have this kind of creative apartheid where we really don't believe that people lower down can have good ideas, because it's very difficult for them to actually get even a small amount of capital to experiment. They just finally give up, right? It's just like those people may be taking all kinds of initiative in other parts of their lives, but at work it's kind of, okay, I'm just here. And so one of the things, and I think this is why the new social technology is so powerful, one of the learned habits people have in organizations is that if I want approval, if I want to do something, the first thing I do is go up. Now when somebody comes to me and says, Gary, how do I have impact? How do I make something happen in my organization? I say, go sideways first. See if you can, you know, get out there, put it on your internal website, build a coalition, get people excited about it. If you get people to devote a few Saturdays to helping you push this idea forward, make it practical, see if you can run a small-scale experiment, now go talk to the leadership team. And the fact of the matter is, most leaders would love to have that kind of initiative in their own organization, but we've kind of bred it out of people.
Has it happened in your own
experience? Yes, exactly. You know, a couple of years ago, I started to see the sea change coming, and you could start to see a lot of organizations around the world that were really experimenting with dramatic new management models, that were managing with no managers. So the question was, all right, how do we bring these to the fore? So we created this little open innovation platform, which people can find at Hack Management, just like hacking, so hackmanagement.org. But the goal was to create a clearinghouse and a forum where anybody in the world could share a story. And we started running these management prize, M-Prize competitions. We've done ones around digital freedom at work, around creating leaders everywhere, around reinventing innovation. And we have had the most amazing, hundreds of amazing stories, for profit, not for profit, every corner of the world. Companies here in Australia like Atlassian, companies in New Zealand, all over the planet. And suddenly you start to see what's happening here. And what I realize, my model for leadership today is much less Jack Welch. And it's much more somebody like Jimmy Wales, who created Wikipedia, where people could share their intelligence, or it's Linus Torvalds, who created Linux and the whole open source. You know, the way you have an impact today as a leader is by enabling others.
Gary Hamill, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And Gary Hamill is a business innovation expert, well-recognized internationally, a visiting professor of strategic and international management at the London Business School. He was in Australia for the World Business Forum in Sydney this week. He's the author of Competing for the Future, written with C.K. Prahalad. And it's a Harvard Business Series publication, if you care to seek it out. And you can find a link to the open innovation platform that he was speaking about, hackmanagement.org, on the Saturday Extra website, his own form of open source leadership. And interestingly, you might have heard the founders of Atlassian, Scott Farquhar and Mike Cannon-Brooks, he just mentioned there, Gary Hamill, mentioned them as great innovators, on Richard Adie's Sunday Profile last week. You can catch up with that interview as well via the RN website. And your thoughts most welcome, whether you think you've experienced this yourself or whether you'd like to see more of it in your particular firms and where you work. Well, look, we're about to go to the news, but after the news, we're going to talk about the dramas at Westfield this week and whether it matters beyond being a Westfield shareholder, and making sense of China's considerably changed behaviour, what it's going to ask of us, what sort of creative diplomacy. That and more, now news time.